Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the FBI is reportedly investigating a political action committee run by Governor Gary Herbert's one-time campaign manager. Also, after a contentious debate, the Salt Lake County Council passes a resolution calling for immigration reform. And Senator Mitt Romney calls out President Trump for appearing to welcome 2020 campaign help from foreign governments. All that and more on the docket today. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also joining us for this conversation is reporter Lee Davidson. And good morning and welcome to you, Lee.
Good morning.
And we've also got news columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome to you, Robert.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation. The number to call is 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can tweet your questions and comments to @KCPW. And let's begin today with Lee Davidson, something that you have been covering. The one-time campaign manager for Utah Governor Gary Herbert has a political action committee, or PAC. And the Tribune reported this week that some members of the public have been complaining about this PAC, and not just here in Utah. Where are these complaints coming from?
Well, it's nationwide. Joe Dema is the former aide to the governor. He currently is vice president of the Mountain Land Technical College. He was chief of staff for Herbert when Herbert was lieutenant governor, ran his 2010 gubernatorial campaign, and he listed himself as a consultant to the governor up until 2016. And that's the year that he formed this PAC, which is called Americans for an Informed Electorate. What's unusual, most PACs raise money to give to candidates or a political party or a cause. This does none of the above. It pays its employees salaries, and it operates surveys. They acknowledge that these surveys are not scientific. They say their political purpose is to try to get dialogue going among people, and they share the results with members of Congress.
So the money's not being spent on campaigns or candidates the way that other PACs spend their money?
That's correct.
Okay.
Utah law is a little unusual. They require a PAC only to be formed for political purposes, and they don't define that. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, because of this brouhaha, is saying, you know, we probably need to go to the legislature and have the legislature give us a better definition. And he said he's concerned because to him, political purposes is raising money for a political candidate or cause or party.
What exactly, I mean, if the money is not being spent on campaigns or candidates, how is it being spent?
Well, it's spent about $900,000 over the last 3 years went to pay its four or five employees. And the rest of the money, you know, they raised about $4.5 million. The rest of the money went to conduct their surveys and to do their business, telephone calls, data processing, that sort of thing.
Hmm. This is the largest PAC in the state of Utah, is that correct?
Well, it's raised the most money over the last several years. Last year, it was number one. Number two was the Utah Realtors. Number three was the Governor's Leadership PAC. And this one raised a lot more money than any of the others.
And again, just to be clear, the what they're doing is raising money, and they're doing this through what method?
Mostly phone calls.
Okay.
They call people. We called several of the larger donors. They were all older people. They're all senior citizens. Many of them, frankly, couldn't remember donating to this group, couldn't remember much about it. Those who did remember it, some thought they were giving to a liberal cause because they were liberals. Others thought they were giving to a conservative cause because they were conservative. One of them, when I told her she was Republican, that a Democrat had told me that she thought it was a Democratic group, she said, well, I guess they're equal opportunity fundraisers. And many of them did not realize how much they had given. They thought they gave once. And I said, well, you know, records show you gave 8 or 9 times and you gave $500. They thought they gave $25. And they said, oh, I guess I need to look at my credit card, you know, statement closer.
What does the PAC say about the critique that they're receiving, which is that they are raising these funds? And then what do they say they're doing with the money? Again, you said that a lot of it is spent on salaries, but what do they say, the PAC say, that they're doing with as a PAC?
They say they're asking people questions. They're using these surveys, but they concede they're not scientific. And they say, gee, we post the results on our website. Actually, if you go to their website, it's very hard to find those results. And if you're not a donor, it's hard to actually see the results. They say they have sent some to Congress, but one of their organizers said, well, we did that early. Another one said, no, we still do it. So it's a little unclear who they're sharing it with. And one of the leaders said, well, we share it with them, but we don't hear much back because, well, we acknowledge we're not a scientific group. And so the questions are questions, but, you know, the findings aren't scientific. So.
Okay. And so that's the extent of what they do is they ask questions and then maybe in some way share that information with candidates.
Correct.
Is that actually useful to any candidates? Are they actually yes, you just said they're not necessarily communicating to the PAC whether or not they're using this information.
The PAC said they've never heard anything back.
When again did Dema, the founder of this PAC, work for Governor Gary Herbert? And in what capacities?
Well, I understand he ran his very first gubernatorial campaign, which was then he became the running mate to Governor Huntsman.
Yeah, so that would have been 2004.
And became his chief of staff as lieutenant governor. And then ran his first gubernatorial campaign for reelection and then was a consultant.
Okay. The governor has made a comment about this in recent days. What has he said?
Well, he had his deputy chief of staff, Paul Edwards, make a statement where he denounced what he called unethical behavior by this group. And then he said, gee, he hasn't been a state employee since 2010, which was a little incorrect. Governor's office later said, well, we meant to say that he left the lieutenant governor's office in 2010. Of course, he then became the governor's campaign manager and apparently has worked with him off and on as a consultant since then. But he says he didn't know anything about this PAC.
Meanwhile, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, as you hinted at the beginning, in his own statement said that he was already aware of the sort of concerns surrounding this PAC and, in fact, that some kind of investigation had been going on. Can you tell us about that part of this, Lee?
He says that 18 months ago, his office turned this over to law enforcement. He did not identify the agency. We've been told by well-placed sources that it's the FBI. Hmm. Cox said that law enforcement asked him not to do anything while the investigation went on. It's been going on for 18 months. He says it's still ongoing. He says that's why he hadn't really gone after this PAC, hadn't really called them to raise flags because whoever it is that was investigating them.
Presumably the FBI. Yeah.
Right. Asked him not to while they're looking into
it. What are the sort of potential violations of law here? I mean, robocalling to raise funds for a PAC, is there any violation of law there?
Lots of people use robocalls to raise money for a PAC. It's how you how you describe what you're doing and if you actually do it or not. You know, there's questions about whether this is a real PAC, but Utah law is admittedly a little murky on that. That said, you know, were they honest in their fundraising? Did they spend money the way they should have? I assume that's what investigations would look into.
And this is sort of a system to collect money and pay salaries and then not, it sounds like, do all that much of substance. I want to bring Salt Lake Tribune news columnist in on this, Robert Gerke. And I mean, do you have a different analysis than the idea that it's not much of substance? I'm sorry that I just put that out there, but there
well,
it is.
I mean, yep. I think it's interesting and it looks shady, it looks bad, but I also, you know, not being an attorney, I don't know that they broke the law. You know, it's
right.
Kind of hard to say that because of because Utah's definition of a PAC is so broad, political purposes are so broad, and it appears they did do survey work. You know, I think there may be some consumer protection issues in terms of the way they were charging people's cards, and these people apparently didn't know that could be against the law. But that's more a consumer protection issue, less a political action committee issue. Either way, I mean, I think it raises a lot of red flags. And also, you know, to go back to what Lee was saying about the governor and his relationship with Joe, Joe is now a vice president of the Mountainland or the Applied Technology College?
Mountainland Technology College.
So you know, he's still been elevated up the ranks of state government, even though apparently, you know, for the last 18 months, certainly Spencer Cox, the lieutenant governor, knew that there was something amiss with this, or potentially amiss at least. I think it raises a lot of questions, and also, you know, why wasn't this addressed? You know, why wasn't there legislation proposed or brought forward by the lieutenant governor's office to say, hey, maybe we need to tighten down our definition of PAC and what this money needs to be used for? You know, it's if you're just raising money to line your own pockets, I don't think that was the intent of the law.
Hmm. Is there, you know, how are PACs kind of overseen? And I guess this probably is a question for Lee. Is that the IRS? Can a PAC lose its status? And, you know, if they're running a scam, shouldn't they lose their status? Or is it just sort of buyer beware or donor beware?
Lieutenant Governor's office is in charge of enforcing election law and looking at such things. Hmm. Of course, Joe Dema once ran that office when Gary Herbert was lieutenant governor.
What is that? Okay.
Hmm. He was chief of staff.
But before he founded the PAC, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And I should have said that Dema says that he stepped away from this PAC, its day-to-day operations, 2 years ago. Hmm. However, he's still listed as a director of a related corporation, and the PAC was still giving him money last year.
Hmm. Robert Gerke, any sort of additional ethical questions raised by what's going on here that need addressing?
Well, I mean, I think there is a legitimate question of whether when he was getting this position with the technical college, whether that was disclosed, whether, when you're a government employee who's getting money on the side from any business, that's typically got to be disclosed under state law. And I think going forward, the legislature is going to have to look at how we define PACs and what we require of them in terms of, you know, a political purpose. Or are we fine with them just being, you know, big money, you know, money vacuums?
Dan Harry, government and politics editor, now that I've put a mic in front of your face that actually works, you know, any comments on the story and sort of the overall picture of, I mean, again, it sounds like nothing illegal happened necessarily.
We don't know.
We don't know that. Good point.
We don't know that. I mean, you know, there could be all kinds of possibilities. You ask why are the feds brought in, for one thing? Because this is it looks on its face like a state issue, but it's raising money nationally. I mean, no one has said this, but I guess it could raise the questions of whether there is a wire fraud case here. I mean, that's one of the Fed's favorite go-tos when they're charging fraudsters, you know, is wire fraud. You know, I think that what this does is it kind of sheds a light on the state of Utah's campaign finance laws, which are pretty darn bad. We don't have many regulations. And this is kind of what happens when you don't have many regulations, is you're going to end up with something that really kind of blows up in everybody's face. The fact of the Dema's relationship with the governor of the state and him kind of trying to distance himself from him, which looks in retrospect sort of disingenuous, it all looks pretty bad.
Lee Davidson, I will rotate this mic back around to you and just ask for, do we just wait now and see what happens with the investigation? And is the PAC still operating, still doing the calls that it's sort of being criticized for?
As far as I know, it's still operating. It has to report donations that it receives within 30 days, and it's been reporting donations received this year also.
Okay. That's Lee Davidson from the Salt Lake Tribune talking about that story. We're going to head to a quick break here. When we come back, there is more ahead on the show, including a look at immigration, a debate over immigration in Salt Lake County. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry, reporter Lee Davidson, and columnist Robert Gerke. Join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to at KCPW. Government and politics editor Dan Harry, assuming your microphone is working here, there is an ongoing national debate on immigration. A microcosm of that debate has been taking place in the Salt Lake County Council just recently. The council was considering a resolution that was sponsored by one of its members that offered support of immigrants and immigrant communities, but it faced a little bit of opposition. Tell us the ins and outs and the twists and turns in the story, Dan.
Yeah, so Shireen Gorbani, who's a descendant of Iranian immigrants, sponsored this resolution. She did so first early this year in the spring, and it failed to pass. And the primary reason it failed to pass was that Stephen DeBry, one of the conservative Republican members of the council, who is also a unified police chief in Mill Creek, made some in March when he voted against this and kind of kept it from moving forward, made some comments that many have objected to as inflammatory. He talked about the crimes associated with illegal immigrants, and that was brought out again in this most recent debate when the resolution did pass. It was watered down a bit, but it finally did pass.
How was it watered down? I guess it expressed, this is about expressing support for immigrant communities, but they added some caveats, or how did it work?
Well, so DeBry wanted to make a distinction between legal and illegal immigrants, and that was really what sparked most of the debate. And it ended up that they did not make that distinction, but they did throw in some language about strengthening the U.S. borders and providing more resources to the Border Patrol. But it kind of – what really got it going was the Alliance for a Better Utah had brought up and quoted DeBry's previous comments, which he kind of tried to distance himself, and you can see why. He talked about the drugs, carnage, and the mules and sex trafficking and everything else from illegal immigration. So it sounded kind of like the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House.
Right.
And, you know, Salt Lake County, even though it's a partisan body, has been known pretty well as kind of a bipartisan model. You don't see a lot of partisan fights on that. So this was outside of what we normally expect from them.
Resolutions, statements of support, they're, I guess, messages to federal leaders from Salt Lake County Council. At this issue, though, immigration is squarely in the hands of the federal government. I guess what I'm wondering is, why is the county council having this debate at this moment in time?
It's symbolic. You know, a lot of the things, for instance, the legislature does is symbolic. But, it called on our members of Congress, Utah members of Congress, to support the more H-2B visas. Mm-hmm. It called for them to end the policy of separating families at the border. And it also asked Congress to finally resolve the issue over the Dreamers, those who were brought here as children illegally and now are kind of in this limbo of can they live their lives here in a legal fashion. We still haven't resolved that, and so they were calling on Congress to finally resolve that.
So much unresolved immigration for so long, and Robert Gerke, columnist of Tribune, your comments there on both on the inflammatory comments from one of the county council members, and on just the fact that we've heard these messages before.
Yeah. Well, I think Councilman Bry's comments sort of illustrate the divide that we have over immigration and why it's been so difficult to get anything comprehensive or even piecemeal done. Utah is unique, as we've talked about before, when it comes to immigration, because for a conservative state, we're very fairly progressive when it comes to support for immigrants and in our opposition to some of the Trump administration's hardline policies. And so for Salt Lake County to make this statement maybe is not surprising. I think you know, if you look at the county provides a lot of health services, obviously runs the jail. It does deal with a lot of the issues that are that are consequence of immigration, illegal and otherwise. And so, you know, it's where the rubber meets the road on a lot of these immigration issues. And for the county to come out and say that it wants a resolution, I think is sensible. You know, but again, you're going to have these hardliners who are going to, you know, who are going to view the issue the way the Trump administration does. And that's why we don't see any progress on this.
Hmm. Just the fact that there's such a divide over.
There's the fact that there's such a divide and they're completely, utterly unwilling to give an inch, you know, they're going to get beaten up for supporting amnesty or whatever else the way the Trump administration has vilified immigrants as murderers and rapists and maybe some good people, you know, is I think really paints this issue in a stark black and white term that makes it impossible or at least very difficult to make any headway on.
I want to bring Lee Davidson in on this as well because, Lee, you did some reporting this week on immigration as well, a report from the Pew Research Center, which shows something about the rate at which undocumented immigrants are arriving in Utah, and also just the general numbers. Can you tell us about this new reporting from Pew?
Sure. It says that there are now 110,000 undocumented immigrants in Utah. That's up 10,000 over the last 10 years. You know, there's a lot of it means several things. The census is coming up next year, and that's a large group of people who are concerned about the census because the Trump administration has proposed asking a question about whether respondents are U.S. citizens. Many undocumented immigrants fear that answering that question would lead to their deportation. The census officials say, well, by law, we can't disclose your personal information to anyone. We can't give it to immigration officials or any other agency. However, that once did happen in World War II. The law was changed to allow using census information to help round up Japanese Americans and put them in concentration camps.
Right.
It's causing a lot of problems with the census. Officials normally depend on what they call trusted voices to convince groups to participate. And in Salt Lake County, officials are saying the trusted voices now don't trust the census. And no matter what happens with this question, a lot of groups are afraid to go out and say, well, it's safe to answer the census because they're not sure.
Whether or not that question ends up actually being on the census is still in the balance. We're waiting from the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court's expected to rule this month. There's been a lot of brouhaha about it in Congress.
There was an interesting development this week, last week, with the Supreme Court case where documents were uncovered after the fact, after the case was already argued, but they were submitted to the Supreme Court, where a Republican strategist had said that the goal of putting this question on here was essentially to undercount these populations in Democratic states and to benefit the Republicans. And so we see that as, you know, as being part of the motivation for this.
Do the numbers work there? Sorry, is it that there are more undocumented people living in Democratic states?
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. The discussion has been, you know, you could see California lose a couple House seats, New York could lose a couple House seats. States like Florida and Texas, which Florida's a purple state, Texas a red state, they could also lose a couple House seats because of their concentrations of undocumented immigrants, and the gains would come to predominantly red states. That's how that would play out. The legislature's been asked to appropriate some money to encourage people to take the census and to facilitate some outreach. I believe Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City have both allocated some money for that. The legislature hasn't, but there's some discussion that they might have a special session before the end of the year in order to in order to try to make that a reality.
In fact, the legislature was asked to do it, but failed to do it during its regular session.
Yeah.
Other states like California appropriated $157 million to help get a fair count. Legislative leaders said, oops, we made a mistake. We should have done something. And they said they're sweeping the corners of the budget trying to find some money to put toward it, or they may consider a special session.
And to say they're sweeping the corners is maybe a little bit disingenuous, because they did hold back, like, I believe, about $900 million that they didn't spend last session. So there's the money is there if they want to allocate, if they want to spend it on it.
It's in a big pile in the
center
of the
room. There just seems to be...
It's buried in coffee cans out in the hills behind the Capitol.
Yeah, yeah. That's where they keep it now. We're going to have a stampede of people out there digging with metal detectors and whatnot. But yeah, so there's money there if they want to do it, and there seems to be an appetite to do it. The question is whether or not they'll get it done.
Dan Harry.
You know, however the Supreme Court ruled, and Lee has reported this, that the damage may have already been done on this thing, that whether the question is actually on the census or not, there is enough fear out there that this is part of what the census is, that no matter if the question's asked or not, there are a lot of people, I think, now that will simply not participate because they're afraid of the possible repercussions.
Lee Davidson, go ahead, Robert Kirky, we're going to cut it off.
Well, it's also just worth noting that it's not just undocumented immigrants who get undercounted in these scenarios. It's anybody. Say you have a family of six who has an undocumented member. All six of those people are not going to be counted, and so if they don't fill out the census, and so there's some concern that it goes well beyond just those people who might be undocumented not filling out the.
And we see that in the Native Americans on the reservations, extremely difficult to count folks out there who don't, in many cases, even have physical addresses, and you have to drive miles and miles and miles to reach them. They don't have phones. And, you know, that is a really critical issue for the state of Utah, where we've seen this, that the population on the Navajo reservation is going to make a big difference now in who controls that county and the county commission.
San Juan County. And, Lee Davidson, go ahead.
Well, before I get too far away from Indians, the Census Bureau has decided to send people directly to their homes this year. They're not going to get a postcard like the rest of us inviting us to participate. Mm. They're sending enumerators directly out there, also on the Ute Reservation. Was going to mention that we did some reporting this week looking at hard-to-count areas in Utah. Mm. And about 12% of Utah, or 12% of Salt Lake County, are in what they call hard-to-count areas with high numbers of minorities or high poverty or... other groups that just in the past haven't been counted well or had undercounts. So
check that out at sltrip.com. And whether or not there's money appropriated to try and help bolster census efforts is yet to be determined. How much, speaking of money, I mean, how much, I guess it's hard to know how, you know, what the lower amount of people, how many less people will be counted as a result of maybe the question, you know, about citizenship being on the census, and what that means for Utah and the money or different counties that they might get or not get otherwise.
Right. Federal grants often are distributed on the basis of population-based formulas. And so if you miss people, you get less in money. And it also affects your representation in Congress and the legislature, even your local city council, usually.
Okay. Robert,
I mean, Utah's not one that would be perceived to be disproportionately affected by this. As Lee mentioned, the estimate is about 110,000 undocumented immigrants.
But there are other groups,
But at the same time, the more you count, the better it is for the state in terms of these federal funds, also in terms of representation, although we're probably not on the cusp of getting a new congressional seat for another 10 years. But it does matter.
Okay. I was going to ask that question about whether or not there was a political effect here in terms of congressional seating, but you just answered that. I want to turn actually to some other news now before we head to another break in the show. And Dan Harry, I'll bring you back into the conversation, and I'm hoping that you wouldn't mind providing just kind of an update on a political story here that has to do with Salt Lake City's mayor's race. There's a debate coming up on June 26th. It's here at the Salt Lake City Public Library. Earlier this week, we learned that not all of the candidates were going to be allowed to participate, and there are a plethora of candidates. That has changed, though. There's what's happening on the debate front, and then we'll head to a break.
Yeah, so the Alliance for a Better Utah decided that they wanted to limit the debate to the four top candidates, and they would determine the top four by doing their own polling, which they released yesterday. This caused quite a brouhaha among the eight candidates who are running for mayor right now. And in fact, several of them got together, wrote a letter, and objected to this. They wanted six to be on the stage rather than eight, than four. Now, why six instead of eight? Well, because you've got a couple of outliers in this race that nobody really gives a shot at winning election. So they wanted all of the serious candidates to be on the stage. And, you know, you can see the debate sponsors' reason for wanting to limit it. I mean, they want to be substantive. They want to get down and ask, you know, questions and have enough time for them to answer fully questions and for the voters to be able to explore where they are on these issues. But the idea that you could actually limit and exclude some of these very, you know, serious candidates, I don't think was ever going to happen. It's just too tough. And what happened kind of you could predict, which was you had the front runner, Jim DeBacchus, and then you had a couple of folks that were in second, third place. And then you had this big cluster of, you know, three candidates that were all polling the same. So
you're describing polling that Alliance for Better Utah did to determine who would show up mm-hmm. in this debate. I wasn't certain if that was clear.
No, it's so, just polling of their approval ratings, okay. of support.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what they were polling.
Thanks.
And so, you know, this could have been predicted, I think, that you would have had a cluster there that would make it too hard to actually choose the top four.
Which is what they said. And so they're having all eight of them participate.
They are now having all eight of them participate. And, you know, the Tribune did a story as this was going on before the polling had been released. And we talked to candidates who were upset about this. And the Alliance was kind of upset at us that they wanted us to wait until the decision had been made. And it's like, you know, that's not what journalists do. That's what historians do. We report the news as it's going on. So all the brouhaha that happened now is over, and there will be eight candidates. You know, will the debate get to those substantial answers now that you've got eight people up on the stage? I don't know. We'll have to see.
I have seen talk of it being a two-hour debate, and I should say that KCPW is partnering with Alliance for Better Utah and the John R. Park Debate Society at the University of Utah to broadcast this debate live. Maybe with 2 hours you can get to all of the candidates.
Maybe you can.
Yeah. Robert Grieke, what is just the fact that this is such a crowded field do for the mayoral race?
Well, I mean, I think the reason it was important to have all of the candidates in this debate was because a lot of people don't know who they want. You know, they don't know these candidates. And so this is their get-to-know-you kind of speed dating opportunity where they can get that introduction to them. You know, people don't tune into the mayoral race until later in the cycle anyway. And so, and as Dan mentioned, we saw it in the poll. We saw, you know, that DeBacchus, a lot of people know Jim DeBacchus. I think only a third of the of those surveyed didn't have an opinion of him. But some of the others were as high as 80%. They didn't, you know, the voters or the voters who were polled didn't have an opinion of. Most of them were around two-thirds, you know. So the voters just don't know. And the poll showed that 34% of people hadn't made up their mind on who they were going to support yet, which I think shows that this is a pretty wide open race. And there is a lot of people out there who are still going to, you know, do some homework on these guys and women as well. To decide who they're going to end up backing. I think the poll was interesting. You had DeBacchus at 27, Luz Escamilla was at 10, and then I think Stan Penfold was at 8,
yeah.
And then you had Ibarra, Garbett, Mendenhall, all at six. I'm forgetting somebody there. But it's a crowded, wide open field at this point. But I think it's good that voters are going to have an opportunity to hear from all of these candidates when they're trying to make up their minds.
Actually, you got all the six serious candidates there.
Okay. Richard Goldberger and Rainier Huck are the other two.
There you go. Well, a lot of voices to squeeze into a debate in a couple of weeks' time. And you can listen here, actually, on KCPW. We'll be streaming it live on Facebook as well, so check that out June 26th. Right now, though, we are going to head to another break in the show. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we'll turn to some national news with a local tie. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Lee Davidson, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255. You can also tweet us at KCPW. Dan Harry, this week, President Donald Trump suggested something that drew a lot of flack from a lot of quarters, including from Utah Senator Mitt Romney. I think most people listening probably know what he said, but what did the president say?
Well, he was asked by George Stephanopoulos whether he would take intelligence on an opponent if it was offered by a foreign government. And he said, yeah, he'd take it.
And Romney, as I said, was one of a number of people who responded to that with incredulity, who were not impressed by that statement.
Yeah. It's.
What did he say?
What's that?
What did Romney say?
Romney said that it was antithetical to democratic principles, that it was flat out wrong, that it was something that has not been considered within bounds in American politics for as long as anyone can remember. You know, we do have laws against foreign interference, foreign contributions to candidates. This isn't the same as, I guess, contributing money, but it is kind of the same. It's contributing resources to a candidate if you're trying to influence an election. And that wasn't that what all that investigation
right.
for 2 years has been about, the influence of a foreign government in an American election? And, why the president would say something like this in the wake of that investigation is just – it's sort of mind-boggling. It really – you question why.
Again, you're right. The special counsel's investigation looked into that exact idea that there were meetings between, offering information or dirt on Hillary Clinton. Robert Gerke, this has been hashed out pretty well in the news.
Yeah.
But your thoughts on these comments from the president and then the response to it, I guess.
Well, I mean, it shows the president doesn't learn from experience. He's completely oblivious to not just social norms, but the law. And, you've got to wonder if he's even been paying attention for the last 2 years. Just nothing seems to have stuck. Nothing that happened over the course of this investigation and the run-up in the campaign and the foreign interference seems to have stuck with him. And he doesn't care. I think it's good that Senator Romney spoke strongly against what the president had to say. Talk is cheap. We'll see if anything, if the senator is willing to stand up to the president when it matters. I mean, but it is good that at least the senator has enough moral conscience to say the fairly obvious thing that what the president said in this situation was completely wrong and illegal and harmful to democracy.
Dan Harry, just final comments on the sort of on again, off again Romney Trump. I don't want to call it a relationship, but Romney's sort of on occasion, as Robert Gerke is alluding to, has been very willing to on certain policy initiatives say I'm happy for what the president's doing, and then in other instances he's been very critical, as we called him a phony and a fraud in the run-up to the election, to the primary, in fact. Any comments there, Dan?
Well, he doesn't do it often, and I think he's sticking to what he said he would do, was he would be an occasional critic of the president when the president did something that he really felt was far out of bounds. And that's pretty much what he's been doing. And actually, to tell you the truth, for a Utah politician, it's quite refreshing. I just want to read here for a second, in contrast, Representative Chris Stewart's statement. And he, like many Republicans, brought up the Christopher Steele, who was investigating Donald Trump and was partially financed by Democrats. So he brought that up, and he said he'd criticized Hillary Clinton for that. And here's his quote about the president's comments. "It would be fairly inconsistent of me not to say the president shouldn't do it either." So that is what Chris Stewart, I guess, intends as criticism of the president. If you can make sense out of that, you're smarter than I am.
Interesting comments there from Chris Stewart. Just before we head to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, I want to circle back to something that we'll leave the story of Romney and Trump behind. And this is something we covered on the show last week, and it's the story of a standardized testing company with a history of problems that got a contract to do testing for students in Utah. And Robert Gerke, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, you wrote a column since we had that conversation last week that raised, at least in my mind, a couple of additional questions. And for example, when I first read the news about this contract that this company got, I didn't realize that the company that Utah had been using to do testing was basically doing just fine. And the question that I have for you is, why did this happen? But you raised some additional questions around the story of Questar Assessments Incorporated. Can you just tell us about that, Robert?
Well, yeah. So Questar is the company the state contracted with after it had ended its relationship with another company, went by the acronym of AIR. And so this other company had helped the state develop the SAGE tests, and helped the state market the SAGE tests with in other states, and as a result, the state generated about $15 million from the sale of that intellectual property, or the leasing of that intellectual property to other states. But the state office decided they wanted to go a different direction, and they ended up going with this Questar Assessments that had, despite both Questar and its parent company ETS having some a sort of a spotty track record, especially in recent years, they went ahead with that. It was supposed to be a 10-year, $44 million contract that, because of the problems with, in one instance, 18,000 students were unable to take the test. They've had to expand the window that they're testing in. There are questions now. The state office is going to have to look at the data they get back and decide whether it's even valid or whether they're going to have to throw it out. These are all serious problems, and so the state board voted to terminate the contract,
right.
And they're going to be pursuing damages potentially against Questar. The legislature next week is going to be bringing people from the state office in to answer questions about how this happened and what they're going to do to keep this from happening again. So, you know, it's turned into a big fiasco. The question is, there were two other bidders that the state has had relationships with, Pearson and AIR, that developed the SAGE test, and both of them have performed well, but this third one that the state ended up going with did not, obviously.
Has anybody taken a stab, at explaining the sort of rationale behind why this company got the contract? I mean, is that obviously, you said that'll be discussed in public education's appropriations interim committee, but so far, has anybody said why it happened? Just the lowest bid?
They were one of the lowest bidders. There were four companies, and I think there was one that was lower. It got dropped out early, and so, but of the three remaining, this was the lowest bidder. The only real explanation that they've given for deciding that they needed to bring in another company was that a lot of parents were opting out of the SAGE tests. You can sign a form. Your child doesn't have to take the test. This was done because Common Core opponents oppose having their children tested. And to be honest, I'd let my kids opt out 1 year just because I feel like they maybe are overtested. But it was done to accommodate or assuage the Common Core opponents who were opposed to these kinds of tests. But that's really a policy question, right? This isn't a question of performance that on the previous tests. And so, you know, but that's where we ended up. And going forward, Senator Lyle Hilliard, I talked to, said he wants some explanation on how it happened and what they're going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Dan Harry?
You know, we've seen some other recent instances that kind of bring into question the state's procurement system here. We saw it recently with the cannabis. We need to contract to get software to track the cannabis and keep data on it. And the company that was selected is one that was, again, the low bidder, but has had some real questions in its performance in other states.
Go ahead.
And then I want to mention one more, which is emergency communication radios that are used by law enforcement and a rescue and fire throughout the state. That's a $50 million contract where we switched providers. Now we're switching providers. And again, it was largely because they were underbidding the existing contractor. We have a system where you're supposed to not only rely on price, but what we're seeing with all three of these examples is it is so weighted so much toward price that even these companies that are outperforming on the technical side are getting overwhelmed when somebody comes in and doesn't underbid. And it does raise questions about, are they underbidding and then coming back and doing change orders that actually drive the price up to more in range of what their failed competitors had bid?
On procurement, do all of the bidders see how much everybody else is bidding and then make a decision? How does the timing on that work? And then another question I have is...
Competitors don't see the others' bids until after it's all over. Then you can explore.
But they're familiar enough with the market to know what the ballpark figure, and then they can cut 20% off of that, and then completely drop the ball and come back.
We're seeing huge differences in those bids in terms of price, and it does raise the question of how can these players in that field have such disparate bids on price.
You brought up the cannabis software system. Mm-hmm. You brought up emergency communication mm-hmm. radios. There's Questar assessments as all maybe problems in that procurement system. Do any of those companies have Utah ties? Do we know?
The winning bidders?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I'm not sure.
No, I think they're all out of state companies. There was one Utah company vying for the assessment. They were the one that dropped out first. There was an interesting commentary in our paper from a former technology officer at the state office who'd said exactly what Dan was saying, that there are the scoring for these is sometimes weighted as much as 40% of it dependent on price, and that he felt like there wasn't enough credence given to the technology end of it, the people who are familiar with the technology, because these companies are really good at hyping things, jargon and whatnot, mm-hmm. and there's not enough credence given to the input from the end user, whoever the people who are actually have the hands-on experience.
I think it's time to relook at that, the way that these are weighted.
The metric. All right. Well, the hour has zipped by, and we're going to have to just quickly turn now to our underplayed stories of the week, the final segment where we highlight something that we didn't cover on the show today. And Lee Davidson, we haven't heard from you in a little while. You got a pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, it's the death of the friendship tree. It was a tree planted by the French president and President Donald Trump a year ago as a symbol of friendship between the two countries, and the tree has died. And, of course, the friendship between the two countries is kind of on critical support. So that's my story.
Interesting pick from Lee Davidson for Underplayed Story of the Week. Robert Gerke, your choice.
This happened yesterday. There was there's an interesting records case going on in San Juan County right now. There has been a request for some The two new Navajo commissioners who are on the county council have been consulting with an outside attorney because, frankly, they don't trust the county attorney to give them good advice. And so they've been consulting with an outside attorney. There was a records request for some of the communications between these commissioners and this attorney. And they've refused to turn it over because they said it's attorney-client. The county attorney, there was a request for the documents. The county attorney said, I don't know what, I can't say if it's public or not. It plays into this whole dynamic where they don't want to turn the documents over to the county attorney who they don't trust in the first place. So the county attorney can't make a determination whether it's public. It's really, and I think this one's probably going to head to court because I'm sure there's some stuff that could be protected. There's some stuff that maybe isn't, but it's a tangled mess.
Tangled mess in San Juan County. Check that out at sltrip.com as well. Dan, Harry, your pick for underplayed story of the weekend quickly.
Water, lots of water, rising reservoirs and rivers. The Great Salt Lake is 2.5 feet above where it was last year. And Lake Powell was rising as fast as 15 inches a day, which is a fantastic rate of rising. The Park Service was warning people not to park too close to the lake.
Wow. Watch out for flooding, everybody, in Utah. I'm going to just go with the Tribune's Bethany Rogers had a piece about the 10th anniversary of the supportive housing development called Palmer Court in downtown Salt Lake City, which is operated by the Road Home. Check out some stories that are really interesting from there. Dan Harry, Lee Davidson, Robert Gerke, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Have a good weekend.
That does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to KCPW producer Tim Pierce for his help with operations today and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. Once again, thanks for joining us. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend, a great Father's Day, and come back again next week.